Chief Frank Fowler, I'm actually not going to say too much except that you know that he was appointed chief at the beginning of this year. He joined the Syracuse Police Department in 1989 after 20 years in the armed forces. And again, I recommend the cover story in the New Times. Chief, thank you so much. Come on up. As much time as you can spend with us. Our normal is, to have some comments from our speaker and then have some questions from the audience. And sure. I have a remote mic that I'll pick questions. So as long as you feel comfortable, we're here, and
okay.
We appreciate you being here.
Sure.
And maybe, I don't know if you can tell us something about what called you away. I have a feeling it has something to do with a lot of we've been reading about in the paper the last few weeks. But Chief Fowler.
Good morning. Thank you for the warm reception, and that's my speech. I'll respond to any questions that you may have. I can talk all day. I could take up as much time as you have talking, but I'd prefer respond.
All right. If there are no pointed questions, I would just tell. Oh, there is one over here. Okay, Marianne.
We read about it, but we'd like to hear you, I think, describe the situation in the city with the youth and that terrible killing.
Well, the last terrible is a great way of describing it. You know, there's a lot of things that I've seen in my lifetime, 21 years in law enforcement, a war veteran, a number of years in the military, but there's nothing that any person can do to prepare themselves for the type of scene that we had to experience this past Sunday. It was a tough investigation, but it was one that we put a lot of effort into. You know, we have young people in our community that are engaging in this type of behavior over and over again. And, you know, I read in the newspaper, and I also see on television where the police are often mentioned and often blamed. But my mother was a wise, wise person, the smartest person I've ever met in my life. And one of the things she told me, she said, Frank, be careful about pointing fingers, because when you point one finger at someone else, there's three pointing back at you. This is a multifaceted problem. And law enforcement is just a small part of it. There's a huge social piece. We're losing the battle long before these young people pick up this gun and are brought to the attention of the police. There's something horribly wrong that goes on in a young person's life to make them decide or make them reach the point where they want to get involved in that type of activity to begin with. Then that's one side of it. The other side is that activity gets and it deserves to get a lot of attention. But one of the things I want to caution everyone in the room and everyone that's listening, if this is aired or run someplace else, in the city of Syracuse, we have a lot of tremendous young people, bright, brilliant, intelligent young people. I'm into our high schools each and every day. The young people that are involved in this life of violence is a small percentage of the great young people that we have in our city. So if you want to look for something, you know, to be optimistic about a light at the end of the tunnel, there are a lot of great young people out there that's going to become productive members of our society and our future leaders.
Question.
Chief Fowler, Jason Allers. I'm a resident of the Strathmore neighborhood, and I happened to be driving here this morning and passed a couple of crime scenes. I wanted to see if, maybe perhaps for my behalf and maybe for Mr. Baker from the Post Standard's behalf, you may have some comments on what happened there this morning.
Did Mr. Baker put you up to that? Tell the truth. Tell the truth, man. I'm the police. Tell the truth.
No, but you and I had spoke at length at a meeting just a couple of weeks ago with the mayor, and we're optimistic of the police department's plans for the city and for combating crime. And it's events like this on Sunday and again today that just send me reeling, and the rest of the neighborhood where I reside and raise a family. So I'd love to hear your comments.
No, that, sir, and that's perfectly understandable. What did you have a question before? Oh, you're next. Okay, he's next. Yes, sir. What we had this morning on Calvin Street, we had a call for a suspicious incident. A male decides to he came to 1413 West Calvin Street, pounding on the door. The people that was inside of 1413 West Calvin Street was familiar with him. They allowed him to come inside. He came inside and he was asking them if he could do some work for them. And while they were telling him no, basically he starts to act very bizarre. He starts to yell and scream incoherently and starts taking off his clothing. Yes, taking his clothing off. Then the male backed away and the female backed away. The guy then runs to the second floor of this apartment and dives like Superman out of the second floor window of 1413 West Calvin Street. Then he goes outside, and at this point, now please understand that I have a team of detectives up in that area investigating this entire thing right now. What I'm telling you is something that we know for right now. There may be some slight variations to this at some point because it's still under investigation, but you guys ask, and here it comes. At some point, he gets into a vehicle, we're told, and he ends up in the 100 block of Arlington Avenue. And there, he makes his way inside of a house that the people don't know him. There's a young lady there with her infant child. He pushes his way into this apartment, and she backs away, grabs her baby, and this happens to be a two-family house as well. And she runs upstairs with the baby, and she calls for the police. The police arrive, and they force their way into the apartment, and the guy's on the floor, turning around in circles, still mumbling incoherently. The police handcuff him. And he's on his stomach, and once they roll him over, they can see by the look on his face that there's a problem here. And they call for an ambulance, asked for the ambulance to really rush and get there. The ambulance, before the ambulance arrived, this person goes limp. Our police officers perform CPR on the person right there in the 100 block of Arlington Avenue before the ambulance arrived. Then the ambulance take over, and they transport him up to Community General, and the person did expire. Okay, and that's the type of things that my officers deal with quite a bit.
Thank you.
Yeah, my question goes to the cameras in the neighborhoods that's coming in. One of my sons... in-laws took a trip to Israel recently, and on the first day they were there, he had his wallet stolen. He went to the police, and they just told him the time and basic location, and they had cameras everywhere, showed the whole incident happening. My point is, though, when they finished all that, they identified, they could see the person that took the wallet and everything else. And they said they couldn't do anything about it, that this happens, I guess, frequently. And even though they had the video and everything else, it wasn't worth pursuing, or they didn't quite say it that way, but they weren't going to pursue it any further. How far and what can the videotaping do for you as a police agency, I guess, is the real question.
You know, I work in the city of Syracuse, and this is where I've been a police officer all my life. I've worked in the state of New York. I'm not going to profess to know the laws of any other state or any other country, but I can tell you about the state of New York and the city of Syracuse. Given the same circumstances, that person would be arrested. That person would be arrested and would be prosecuted. That's tremendous evidence, you know, with the camera and the video. And you would see a big smile on our detective's face if they had that type of evidence, and that person would, in fact, be arrested.
Chief, hi. I wanted to know, I read your article, and it was talking about the gang violence, and I guess I wanted to know specifically what is statistics as to how many gang members really are in the city of Syracuse, and also it alluded to RICO, and I wanted to know if we're getting any federal or state support in helping getting some of these people off the street.
And I don't know what article you're referring to when you say my article, but that's fine. I can still answer the question. How many gang members? That's a difficult question to ask. We in Onondaga County, and in the city of Syracuse, and right in the public safety building, we're very fortunate to have a crime analysis center. There's only five in the state, and we're very fortunate to have one of them. And there's a tremendously intelligent crime analyst that work in the crime analysis center. And we have them, their tasks divided up into very specific areas. One of the areas that we concentrate on is the gang area. We have a tremendous amount of gang intelligence, and so we kind of have an idea of a very good idea of how many gangs there are. We have a very good idea of how many active, when I say active, I mean actively involved in criminal activity. But each day, somewhere in our neighborhood, somewhere in our community, unfortunately, as a young person looking to round a corner, looking to elevate themselves in terms of their gang status. So when you ask me the number of gang members, that number changes each and every day. You have young people that are saying, hey, I've had enough of this. This is not what I thought it was going to be. They get out. Then you have younger people joining. So it's very difficult to give you an exact number. All right. And as far as there was a second part to your question, too. RICO. As far as RICO and other aid that we're getting, RICO is always an option. It was successful in the past, and it's not something that we're ruling out for the future. And state aid, we still use Operation Impact. The New York State Police is a tremendous help to us. They're a great partnership. And then also the Onondaga County Sheriff's Department, they work with us through Operation Impact. Sheriff Walsh and I have a great working relationship, and they have a tremendous. We're very fortunate that we have some great deputies that work in the county. They do come into the city periodically to assist us. So we do have a great working relationship with our law enforcement partners.
Chief, we have tremendous violence here, and we read about the violence in Mexico, and it seems absolutely clear that drugs and the drug traffic allows the profit and these gangs and the weapons. A two-part question. First is, could you talk about how would you do things differently? We've been 40 years war on drugs, and it's hard to say we've made any progress at all. Could you propose anything? Do you think anything different in terms of drugs? And then a different kind. Do you see in terms of truancy in schools, could we do anything different there to help alleviate the gang problem?
First question about drugs. I worked 8.5 years, almost half of my law enforcement career in narcotics. That entire 8.5 years I've spent working undercover. I would like to think that I've made probably more hand-to-hand drug transactions than any police officer in my police department right now, and I'll match the numbers up with them. So I know up front, firsthand, and real close about this drug problem that you speak of. We have new drugs that are coming into our community, and they are absolutely destroying lives. I had a person tell me once that he felt that drugs, this was a prosecutor, he told me that drugs, here's what he said to me. He said, Frank, calm down. Drugs are a victimless crime. Well, that kind of like lit the fuse on a stick of dynamite for Frank that day, because I went on to point out to him that drugs are a victimless crime. And I pointed out to him how many victims lay in the wake of people who are involved in drugs. That's why some of these children that we talk about that are involved in violence and truancy and things of that nature, that's why they're involved in this stuff, because they don't have a chance from the beginning. You know, crack cocaine has done something that no other time period, no other thing in society has ever done. Crack cocaine is the only thing that has occurred in the history of our society that would cause a mother to walk away from her baby. And when I was working undercover, I saw that over and over and over again, the devastation of this family, where you have the mother would leave the child alone, take whatever food, whatever thing they saw of any type of value, and go and sell that, sell her body, just for this drug. So these drugs are very, very dangerous. But you have to understand the war on drugs. The war on drugs is fought at various levels. Our line, we're on the front lines here locally in fighting this war on drugs. I don't profess to know what the federal government is doing across the board. Maybe they're doing a lot of great things that I'm unaware of, sir, so I really can't speak to that. But somebody somewhere along the way is kind of missing this thing, because these drugs are still getting into our community. My special investigation guys, they're knocking down doors every day, conducting search warrants, and drugs are continuing to come into our community. And it is a huge problem, and it's one of the big contributing factors to gang problem, to criminal activity, because you have people that get hooked on the drugs. Then you have the allure of the fast profits. You don't need to submit a resume to become a drug dealer. You just need a certain amount of money and go and knock on the right door or make the right phone call, and boom, you're in business. And so that's those are the difficult things that we face here locally. As far as truancy is concerned, yeah, truancy is a big contributing factor to a lot of the criminal activity. It's a direct correlation to some of the burglary investigations that we find ourselves involved in. Burglary is on the rise in our city. Our arrests are up, and we find ourselves arresting more and more juveniles. You're gonna hear a story, if it hasn't already broke, about a young man, a juvenile, that was arrested for multiple burglaries and was just let right out of jail. And then the neighborhood is like, hey, wait a minute, hang on for a second. And they're in an uproar because they were an integral part of assisting us in arresting this young man. And he's committing these burglaries while he should be in school. Now, I'm not blaming the school system for this. You know, that young man should have some adults that's responsible for them. And I'd like to think that they play a role in the fact that he's not in school. So truancy, yep, it definitely plays a significant role in crime, because if the young person's in school, then they're not out committing burglaries or getting involved in violence or in any other criminal activity.
Good morning, Chief.
Good morning.
The question that I want to ask you is about responses in communities where there is violence. And it seems to me, maybe this is optimistic, that you're getting more cooperation in the communities. They're expressing their outrage and their intolerance and willing to step forward and tell you things that you need to pursue an investigation. Is that true? And if so, can we look at that on a grander scale and hope that down the road, if more communities take responsibility and band together, could that have an impact on the amount of drug traffic and violence and whatnot across the city?
What's your first name?
Donna.
Donna, I like you. Let's everybody give Donna a round of applause for me. And I say that because, Donna, I've heard on the news a couple of times, and I've heard people who don't have a clue say, police and community relations, and if the police had a better relationship with the community, that's garbage. Our relationship with the community is improving, and it's improving greatly, and it's going to continue to improve, because you know why? That's extremely important to me. I understand and I appreciate the value of our community. We are getting people to come forward. We wouldn't be able to solve the type of crimes at the rate that we're solving them without our community. And yes, you're right on the money with community involvement, because when the community stands up and demonstrate that they're not going to tolerate lawless acts within their own communities and that they're going to call the police, they're going to reach up and pick the phone, phone up, they're going to call their neighbors, they're going to alert people, they're going to educate people, they're going to become involved. That's going to be a neighborhood that's unattractive to the criminal element. And we're going to push this activity out and away and ultimately working together to solve this and making our neighborhoods better. That is, in fact, the answer.
Chief, I'd like to ask you a question about the distribution, geographic distribution of violent crime in Syracuse. And often we hear, I run a business in downtown Syracuse, live there, and I feel very safe in downtown. We're always trying to encourage people from the suburbs to come downtown and take advantage of the great facilities that we have there. But people are afraid. And I think that there's not enough information about the actual distribution of crime in our city. We hear about cameras going up in the near west side. We hear about the south side. We hear, but I'd like you to speak a little bit about downtown as opposed to some of the areas. And where is the majority of the violent crime in the that you find in the city area?
Well, the crime is the violent crime is really specific to those who are involved in criminal activity, and you can say, well, Chief, what about that 2 month old what about the 20-month old baby? You can't say that baby was involved in criminal activity. You're absolutely right, but I can say that the baby's father is involved in criminal activity. I can say that the baby's father is riding around with the baby in the van with him. And while rival gang members spotted them and with the intentions of killing the father, the baby was killed. I can say that. And when you look at crime, and you look in particular violent crime, there's generally a relationship between people. Either there's a relationship between people or some type of argument or some type of, we often refer to it as a beef, occurs between two people. You rarely see random acts of violence in a city, you rarely see stranger on stranger random acts of violence. There are plenty of random acts of violence, and they occur in different pockets throughout the city, and it's something difficult to track and anticipate for law enforcement because it's something that just happens. And as far as downtown is great. We had done and we will continue to do a lot of work downtown with our partners. Mayor Miner understands the importance of downtown and downtown businesses. We want to make sure that people who are doing business coming into the city to do business downtown, people who own businesses downtown, we want to make sure that they're safe and it's safe for them to do business. That's one of the few areas that we, with shrinking resources, I had to put additional personnel downtown because of a problem that popped up. And I will say to you, we have that problem under control, and we're constantly keeping an eye on our downtown areas as we are with our other areas. Downtown is, I wouldn't say it's more important than any other part of our neighborhood. But we had a very unique problem downtown that we really, really had to address, and we've done that. And so I would say to you that downtown is safe, and we're continuing to watch, look at downtown, and monitor the activity down.
Chief, last spring I did a little tiny bit of work at Grant Middle School, and the impression I came away from that experience was this community is unwilling to invest in kids at risk, that we've got schools, we've got police department, we've got all sorts of agencies, but for some reason or other, we cannot work together to deal with these issues. From your perspective, do you think that's true, or do you see some great things happening for kids at risk?
I don't think that that's true, and I'm not the school district or any other agency. I'll speak for law enforcement. I'm willing to work with anyone. I know that I live in a world of shrinking resources. I know that I live in a world of new and changing times. I know that there's different types of problems that are popping up. I know that we have to reach people young, early, and often in order for us to gain and maintain any measure of success in terms of stemming the tide of violence and increasing young people's graduation rates and stuff like that. I understand the importance of that. So I'm willing to work with anyone, and I can just only speak for myself here. You want to talk about people often refer to thinking outside of the box. I don't even know where the box is. So that's how far I'm willing to reach out.
You were interviewed after the death of that 20-year-old child. 20-month-old child, I beg your pardon. And you said something like, well, if this doesn't change things, nothing will. Now, was that a wish or an expectation?
It's an expectation, sir. Listen, you have a right. When people stop me, you call my name, I stop in my tracks. Why? Because I work for the community. I am a public servant, and I am proud to be a public servant. And I'm also a citizen, right? And I'm very optimistic about the city that I live in. And looking at that situation with the 20-month old baby, right? I'm a firm believer that we can look at any situation, and if we're open-minded enough, we can excuse me, I got to take this. I'm sorry about that. I told you guys earlier about what was happening. That investigation is continuing, and there's some stuff that's occurring up in the Criminal Investigation Division that required my attention. No. I just had to respond to that question. Did I finish? Wait. I think we probably should go back to his question, because I was distracted by my phone call. So my expectations. I have very high expectations of myself, and you all deserve to have a right to have high expectations of me. And as a result, I have high expectations of our citizens. I think that I think that the majority of the people in our great city of Syracuse are just that. They're great, great people. And I think they're just as tired of this stuff as anyone else is. And I think that from the death of this 20-month-old baby, you're going to see a lot of people that weren't involved in stuff before start to get involved in stuff. And that's just my belief.
In your opening remarks, you indicated that the police were just a tiny bit of the problem-solving mechanism here. Even though this may be outside your field of expertise, I'd like to know what you think should be done by people in the city to reduce the crime rate, besides having a good police force.
All right. Well, here you go. Let's start with the juveniles first. Let's start with the young people. When you look at young people, let's take a civil tort, for example. If a 15-year-old goes out and he smashes out your window in your house, right? You're going to call the cops, hey, this person smashed out my window. You're going to go over and talk to the parents. You may say something to the 15-year-old, but you're going to go right to the parents. Why is that? You want your window fixed. 15-year-old don't have a job, but their parents who are responsible for them, they have a job. You want your window fixed. That's the end result. You want your window fixed, and you'd like to prevent it from happening again. So you go right to the parent. Without hesitation, that's what people do. Something like that happens, that's exactly what we do. Because you know that, yeah, the child's behavior was wrong, it was reckless, it may have even been criminal. But you know that there's a social side connected to that too. And the only way to get at that is through the parent. Because you want your window fixed, and you don't want it to happen again. See, in our society, we do a real good job of that. It's the parents slam the door in your face, say, I get lost, I'm not paying you. Oh, really? You're not? I happen to know about this place called Small Claims Court. If I go there, guarantee you, you go to Small Claims Court, the parent don't show up, you get a judgment, you call the marshals, hey, go over there, assist me, serve this person, I want to garnish their wages. I want to go through every step I can to get my money, not from this 15-year-old, but from the 15-year-old's parent, right? Well, every other part of crime that involves a juvenile is just as much social as it is criminal. In fact, I'm willing to argue that only 20% of a 14-year-old committing a burglary is criminal. The act itself is criminal in nature. But the fact that a 14-year-old has rationalized in his mind that he's going to wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, go and crawl in somebody's window and steal their property, something horribly wrong took place leading up to the actual act of burglary. And we don't hold the parents, we're not holding adults that's connected to these young people accountable for that. And people will counter that by saying, well, Frank, you know, some people don't know, or some people don't, some people aren't able to, their kids are out of control. I witnessed in the lobby of the public safety building one morning, a mother. She had the pajama bottoms on, and she had a scarf tied around her head, and she had her son that was about 3 inches taller than her, and she was berating him. Let me tell you something, you know, don't you ever, you know, you can't. And she had just gotten him out of the youth division upstairs. And her biggest issue was her son had inconvenienced her because she had to get out of bed and come down and get him out of the custody of the police. And she, boy, was she letting them have it. And I said to myself, I said, that's part of the answer right there. These adults that's connected to these kids need to be inconvenienced a little bit more. We're not inconveniencing them enough. Because, see, you take the juvenile, and let's go back to the 20% criminal part, right? Take the juvenile, commits a burglary, the police grab him, and let's assume that throughout the justice system, everybody does their part. There's a joke there. Thank you. And the young person is placed in some type of a placement facility for young people. They're going to counsel him, work with him, probably even make him get up and go to school every day. They're going to try to turn him around. But what's going to happen at some point, he's going to be put right back in that same place where he was able to rationalize that behavior to begin with, and then that vicious cycle is going to start all over again because everything else that came into that young person's life is an exception. The norm is that garbage that's taking place in their household. So I say to you, if we inconvenience the parents by making, if your child is involved in criminal activity, and you bring them in and say, okay, now that your child is involved in criminal activity, we're going to do an assessment of your household. We want to find out how you all got to this point. Not just your son, but you, your husband, or whoever is connected to this person, how you got to this point. Because, and then if we did that, guess what we can also do? We can use our social service agencies a little bit better, where we can target specific problems. We have some great, great social service agencies here in Onondaga County with tremendous service, and they're overwhelmed also. But we can use these things a little bit better because we can start to pinpoint specific areas. But we're not doing that, and I think that's where we're kind of losing the battle at it, with these young people. Okay?
Chief, that was so good that I'm not sure if this is redundant following up. That was such a wonderful plan. But you have always been such a proponent of prevention programs, and I wondered if money was no object, where would you want to see money put in the prevention area?
When we look at, and right back to young people, right? Because I think that's where we got to start. We got to give young people a chance. And when we look at, you take three young people and you dress them the same, you can look at them and they may all look the same. I use an analogy of sponges. You know, you take three identical sponges and you fill one up with vegetable oil, one up with water, one up with gasoline. And you stand from a distance and you look at those three sponges, they all look alike. The only way you're going to tell the difference between those sponges is that you put them under pressure. And when our children are put under pressure, you'll see exactly what's inside of them. And they're put on under pressure each and every day. So when we look at them, we look at them from a distance, we take for granted that they're all alike. They're not all alike. They don't come from good households. There's a lot of adults that are surrounding these young people that are teaching them and displaying to them on a daily basis some very, very bad habits that they're going to eventually pick up on, and then they're going to become news stories for us. So if money was not an object, I would say we should consider, like, not a boot camp but a military style school where we send these young people to, and we keep them there straight through high school, right? Because some parents are overwhelmed, and they should be able to. And if the parents say, you know, I can't do it, I'm failing here, and I need some help with structure and discipline, the parent is able to bring their child to a place that's going to provide them with structure, discipline, and to educate them and give them a great chance, an equal opportunity to be successful in society. And the child is going to learn values. They're going to learn the types of things that they need to learn in order for them to be productive members of society. And so when societal pressures come, the young person has been taught and has been shown and has learned how to deal with that, right? So we got to take them out of the element that they're in. And the reason why I'm able to answer this question, I'm answering a question like this, is because you're looking at a product of urban America. I grew up in a very impoverished, tough area of St. Louis, Missouri. And people have looked at me early on in my young life and said, this guy here, he's not going to make it. I could tell you right now, I could tell you what his future looks like. But because I love my mother so much, and I felt my mother had really, she deserved much more from her child, who's the youngest of 11 children. She deserved so much more. I went out and searched on my own to figure out, Frank, how do you make a difference? How do you get out of this environment, and how do you become a productive member of society? I didn't have a lot of examples that I could turn and point to people that I could have a conversation with. And I joined the Army. And when I joined the Army, it was an interesting culture shock for me. But that was the thing. Structure, discipline, a sense of belonging, understanding my place not only in my own community but in my world and in my society. And I bought in, and I haven't looked back since. But that's just Frank Fowler, one person. So when I say that type of school, I have in mind my own path to where I got to when I got here. And if I can be standing here today before you all with 4 stars on my collar as your chief of police, there's other young men that's out there in urban America someplace that can do the exact same thing that I can, but they just need a chance. They just need an opportunity.
Thank you. Chief Fowler, about what proportion of members of your police force actually live in the city? And what are your views on that situation? I know there's a state statute that prevents your organization from actually mandated that Syracuse police people live in the city. But can you think of any incentives that you would like to see put in place that would encourage more of them to do that?
Okay. I think a very small percentage, somewhere around only 20% of the police officers live in the city. And I said I think because that's a guess, okay? So if you find out that there's more, there's less, don't say, hey, that chief lied to me. No, he took a guess, and if you... Yeah, so about 20%, and I think that's I think I'm going to be pretty close with that, ma'am. That's one of the few questions that you're going to find me on a fence about. Okay, and let me tell you why I'm on the fence about it. I believe there's some definite advantages to police officers living in the city. I lived in this city ever since I've come to this area. I've been a police officer for 21 years. I lived in this area probably about 24 years. So most of the time I've been here, I've been a police officer. And all of that time, I've lived in a city. As long as I live in this area, I will continue to live in a city. I'm not telling you I'm going to continue to live in this area, because at some point there's a warm climate with a set of golf clubs and a boat with my name on it. Let me put that out there first now, okay? But I think there's some definite advantages to police officers living in the city, because when you get to know your neighbors and they can call you by name, I can go anywhere in the city and you have people that will refer to me as Mr. Fowler, Chief, Frank, Coach, or Uncle Frank. I have about 3,000 nieces and nephews. All right? So I think there's some definite advantages to police officers living in the city, because if you pull a person over at the corner of Calvin and South Salina Street in a vehicle and traffic stop, and the same person you're likely to run into in a grocery store. We do have one grocery store in the city. Let's take, out there on Price Chopper on Erie Boulevard? Okay. Wegmans on Pond Street. Okay, I forgot. Okay, let's take Wegmans on Pond Street then. And you're likely to run into the same person in the grocery store on Wegmans and Wegmans on Pond Street. Your chances are you're gonna treat that person a little bit differently. I said chances are. And most of our police officers are professionals, and they're going to treat people the same way regardless to where they live. But I think if it's your neighbor, or it's likely your neighbor, you form relationships, and then through relationships, you start to deal with people a little bit differently. Now, here's the other side of that. Our job is one of the few occupations where the person wakes up, gets ready to go to work, kiss their family goodbye, and the family sits there and not knowing if they're going to return back home at the end of the day. The police officer goes to work just like anyone else in their job, and they work hard. Some work overtime, and they have a view. They have a vision of how they want their house to look when they pull in the driveway, how they want their family structures to look, how they want their children to feel when they go to school, and they have every right to go out in pursuit of that. So if they want to have a huge yard with a lot of land and those things, you know, what do you eat? I'm an urban kid, so you know the thing they ride around in the woods and stuff in. If they want to have what is ATVs? Okay, all right. I almost said MTV, but ATVs, yes. If they want to have that, they're entitled to that. So that's why I'm on the fence. They're entitled to, the police officer is entitled to determine how their home environment should look and where they live and raise their family. Their families didn't sign up for this job as police officers. The police officers themselves did. And they have a right to raise their family where they want. But I think there's some definite advantages to police living in the city.
Chief Fowler, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk to us today.